Good day. Today is Wednesday, 18th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, over the last 24 hours, we've had confirmation from the Iranian authorities that Ali Larijani, Khamenei's national security advisor, the person who was put in overall charge of Iran's security and defense apparatus by the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, after the protests in January, that Ali Larijani was indeed killed, as the Israelis claimed, in an airstrike over the previous night. And incidentally, and for the record, the Israelis this morning are making more claims that they have also managed to kill a senior official, perhaps the head of Iran's intelligence service. So, since Iran has various intelligence agencies, I'm not sure exactly what role this person has. Now, when the Israelis make these claims, I've tended to see they have been, well, almost invariably correct ever since the present Israeli process of killing senior officials of Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, all of the other organizations and entities and indeed states that Israel has been in conflict with. And, well, so it proved in the case of Larijani. I've made this point before, and I think that, as I said, when the Israelis make claims of this kind, they should be taken seriously. They are clearly on the hunt for these people. They clearly have means of observing what happens inside Iran. Prior to the attack on Khamenei's residence on the 28th of February, Iran apparently hacked all of the traffic control CCTV cameras around the residence, which enabled the Israelis to keep careful observation of who was coming and who was going. They undoubtedly have had, in the past, informants within the highest levels of Iran's defense and security apparatus. I've discussed in several recent programs the perhaps pivotal role of the former head of the Quds Corps, General Kani, in probably providing Israel and indeed the United States with information. And, well, it's now clear that despite the arrest and probable death of General Kani, either by execution or suicide, that the Israelis still have information sources within Iran, be these electronic or human, it's impossible for me to say. But the point that I made at great length in my programme yesterday remains, or so it seems to me, valid. The Israelis can kill senior Iranian officials like Larijani, like whichever head of Iranian intelligence they managed to kill over the last few hours. But how is that ultimately changing the picture? In 2024, they managed to kill a large number of the leaders of Hezbollah in Lebanon. They killed its long-standing and charismatic leader, Hassan Nasrallah. But Hezbollah is still there, and the Israelis have apparently been taken by surprise by its ability to resist the latest Israeli attacks and to conduct strikes of its own against Israel. And As I understand it, similar things have been attempted with the various Iraqi militias, Shia militias in Iraq, and no doubt with the Houthis in Yemen as well. But all of these parties remain standing. They continue to fight Israel. Even Hamas in Gaza remains in existence. It continues to be an armed force. It has not lost cohesion or political direction, notwithstanding Israel's success in killing off many or even most of its best known leaders. So Israel persists with its decapitation strategy, but it is not changing the strategic calculus of this war. It's perhaps a difficult thing for the Israelis themselves to understand, given how much time they have invested in this decapitation strategy. And by the way, when I talk about it in that kind of way, let me make it very clear that I don't agree with it at all. On the contrary, I strongly disapprove of it. I discussed in my program yesterday how civilians, including children, get caught up in it. And that seems to me, well, that is totally wrong to me. But anyway, I can understand at a political and intelligence level, given the ruthless calculus that the Israelis have brought to their conflicts in the Middle East, why they are not prepared to give up with this decapitation strategy. But it is not winning the conflict for them, at least not at the moment. Maybe a point will eventually be reached where there are no people in Iran who are able to take over and maintain Iran's cohesion in the conflict. But that doesn't seem to be true at the moment. In fact, it clearly isn't true at the moment. And it may never be. And, well, the killing of Larijani perhaps brings us to a further point, because I've read a number of comments now by former Western officials, including one who wrote, I think it wasn't exactly an official, he was a journalist, who wrote for the Daily Telegraph, of all places, in which this person actually said that from his own contacts with Larijani, he had formed the view that this was exactly the sort of person with whom a long-term deal might be made. A deal perhaps like the JCPOA, which Larijani negotiated, and perhaps other deals also providing for limits in terms of the conflicts in the Middle East in the future. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that Larijani was any sort of moderate. I'm simply saying that he was not the kind of implacable, fanatical personality that people in the West far too readily assume all Iranian leaders to be. But, of course, eliminating him does remove from the scene an experienced negotiator, somebody who has conducted negotiations on behalf of Iran in the past, and there is no certainty that whoever replaces him, and that person, whoever he is, probably is already in charge in Iran at the moment. There is no certainty that that person is going to be more accommodating. It is far more likely that he will be less so. Killing leaders like Larijani, who perhaps might be more willing to conduct negotiations and replacing them with more hardline personalities, in terms of the strategic calculus, of course, makes little sense to me. Now, of course, there will be those who will say that one of the reasons why Larijani was eliminated was precisely because he might have been someone that might eventually have been prepared to engage in negotiations, and that there are people in Israel, perhaps Prime Minister Netanyahu, who want to close off that option. I know that is a widespread view. But that only works, and again, when I say works, to be clear, again, I don't agree with this whole approach at multiple levels. But this only works if the war against Iran is eventually won. Now, I've seen a number of articles. There was one, for example, by a man called Raphael Burr in The Guardian, a well-known commentator there, which says that whilst for the United States, the objective in Iran was regime change, for Israel, they would be happy with something significantly less: the collapse of Iran, the destruction of its entire political system, the destruction of Iran's ability to function as a state at all. All of these are things that Israel might settle for. If even that cannot be achieved, then destruction of Iran's military-industrial capabilities, its ability to conduct missile strikes against Israel, its ability to move forward with a nuclear weapons program, even that would be for Israel a significant achievement, and Israel would perhaps settle for that. Better that than some kind of negotiated resolution to the conflict. Well, plans to completely destroy Iran, in my opinion, would create vast problems for the entire region and ultimately for Israel itself. But putting those terrifying ideas to one side, ideas which I increasingly doubt are achievable, by the way. Iran has held together under the pressure of this war, so why assume that it is indeed going to break down in the way that some people believe? Putting aside that, it seems to me that for Israel, given how far this conflict has now gone, anything short of regime change would indeed be a catastrophic strategic failure. Again, I think people underestimate the speed with which industrial structures can be rebuilt, missile factories can be revived, missile capabilities can be restored. And if at the end of this crisis, Iran comes through with the same political system that it had before this crisis, but with a younger, more radical, more radicalized political leadership, then it seems to me that Israel's overall position has become far worse. Such a leadership, having survived the present crisis, would feel both angry and confident, and of course they might actually be prepared to go to places where the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, was never prepared to go, by moving forward with a nuclear weapons program. Now, on that point, about a week ago, I read on Naked Capitalism a long and very interesting article about the development of Israel's own nuclear weapons program, extending all the way back to the mid-1950s. And it was very interesting to see how many outside parties were involved. The French, the Belgians, all sorts of people participated in it at various times. The United States eventually also became involved, or so it seemed to me. But, well, all that was very interesting. Discussions also about the problems with the Dimona reactor, the fact that it is overworked and overused, that there are big question marks about what Israel does with the nuclear waste from that reactor. You can read the article itself on Naked Capitalism, and that will provide some possible answers to those questions. Now, that's the thing that interested me most and concerned me most was a claim, which I've never seen anywhere else before, that Iran has a long-standing relationship on nuclear weapons issues with North Korea, and that North Korea has tested two nuclear devices for potential eventual development by Iran. In other words, the Iranians have not conducted nuclear weapons tests on their own territory, but the North Koreans, by arrangement, have been doing it for them. Now, I want to stress, I don't know that that is true. I have no other information which confirms that. I don't know where the author of this article obtained that information from. But that North Korea and Iran have a long-standing and very friendly relationship with each other that goes back decades is a matter of full public record. And North Korea, of course, withdrew long ago from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has a significant nuclear weapons arsenal, some parts of it now very advanced. It would be perfectly within the realm of the possible that North Korea could assist a future hardline Iranian government with a nuclear weapons program, which might in that case progress quickly, far more quickly than perhaps I might have expected if it had been done by Iran by itself. Which brings us back to this question. Surely the better solution to Israel's long-term security problems, insofar as they relate to Iran, would be some kind of agreement, not that different maybe from the JCPOA, JCPOA too, that addressed some of the issues in that agreement, for example. An agreement that would have built on Khamenei's fatwa prohibiting Iran from developing nuclear weapons, as against this conflict that we are seeing now, in which Israel continues its decapitation program of the Iranian leadership, but finds that that leadership, like the mythological creature, the Hydra, simply grows more heads whenever one of those heads is lopped off. Well, anyway, that's all I'm going to say about this. In every other respect, in every other regard, the situation continues exactly as before. Iran continues to conduct drone and missile strikes across the Middle East. It continues to conduct missile strikes against Israel itself. There is very little information about the damage that these strikes do, though thankfully, so far, it seems that there have been few human casualties. There, of course, continue to be missile and other strikes against Iran itself by Israel and the United States. Appallingly, these have caused significant human casualties, civilian casualties, starting with that attack on the school that we saw on the very first day of the conflict. And in the meantime, the Straits of Hormuz remains closed. Energy prices continue to rise. There is growing information about a general energy shortage. The Gulf states are finding themselves in an ever-deepening crisis and are becoming increasingly restless and visibly unhappy. They are increasingly asking whether their alliance with the United States was a trap rather than a protection. Many of them are now seriously worried about their long-term future, or perhaps I should be more exact and I should say that the royal families and political establishments of these countries are now increasingly worried about their long-term future. Saudi Arabia seems in a better position because it is still able to export oil through the Red Sea, though only in limited quantities compared to what it used to export via the Strait of Hormuz. And for the record, I believe that most of that oil is going to China. And that is another reason why China at the moment is relaxed or relatively relaxed about this conflict. And I think it is a further reason also why the Houthis in Yemen are not interfering with its export trade, because they have been told by the Chinese and by the Iranians not to interfere with these oil exports from Saudi Arabia through the Red Sea, because they're going to China, which is, of course, Iran's ultimately most important financial backer and BRICS partner. And, well, again, we get a sense of the extraordinary weakness in some respects of America's hand in this conflict, because none other than the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has now come out and publicly said that the United States is not interfering with Iran's energy exports because it does not want to create further disturbance in the international oil markets. A bigger confession of weakness in this conflict, at least in the economic aspects of this conflict, it would be difficult to come up with. It seems that it was also Scott Bessent and the US Treasury that vetoed the president's plan for the United States government to provide insurance to the ship owners whose tankers and ships are bottled up in the Persian Gulf and are unwilling to risk the Strait of Hormuz, if only because the commercial insurers in London have pulled the insurance cover. Scott Bessent, I suspect, understands that such a plan would indeed require authorization by Congress, that it would prove controversial and probably as unworkable as well. Incidentally, on the topic of Scott Bessent, it was he who seems to have had discussions with the Chinese in advance of Trump's previously planned trip to China at the end of this month. The word now is that the meetings did not go very well, that the Chinese did not prove especially helpful to the Americans on all sorts of topics, that the preparations for the trip weren't moving forward at all. And I've always said, and we on the Duran have always said, that Trump anyway would be extremely reluctant to go to Beijing and face Xi Jinping whilst he has an unresolved crisis with Iran, a crisis which is creating havoc in global energy markets and is threatening recession in the global economy, including, by the way, the US economy, and which is damaging, perhaps terminally, the president's own political position in the United States. Anyway, that's where we are in the overall picture. I've noticed that over the last few days, the claims in the United States that the Russians are providing significant assistance to Iran in terms of intelligence, in terms of assistance for Iran to conduct its missile and drone strikes, that this information is increasingly becoming uncontested. And I should say that I've also noticed that there is no sustained denial of any of this, either in Moscow or Tehran. As I said, the Russians provided, or rather the Russian embassy in London provided a somewhat less than convincing, at least to me, denial of Russian involvement, perhaps not in the strike itself, but in the general assistance that Russia has provided to Iran that might have made possible the strike, the Iranian strike on the base in Iraqi Kurdistan near Erbil, where British troops were located. I understand that there have been, well, Macron has already also complained about strikes by Iran on bases where French military personnel were located, and one French soldier up to now has publicly been reported to have been killed. I saw reports yesterday that another base in the Middle East, where German military personnel are said to be stationed, was also attacked by Iranian drones. And this morning I saw reports, or at least I saw headlines about reports of further Iranian attacks on other bases in the Middle East where British personnel were located. I said in a program I made some time ago that the Russians back in 2024 gave warnings that if there were missile strikes by the Western powers via Ukraine on Russian territory, the Russians would take counteraction. I mentioned that the Russians had called in the British and French ambassadors at that time, back in 2024, and warned them that the Russians, perhaps through proxies, would reserve to themselves the right, if such missile strikes using British or French or indeed American missiles were carried out against Russia, that the Russians would reserve to themselves the right to do the same thing against military bases with British, French, and other Western personnel all around the world. I said recently that I don't see why what we're seeing in the Middle East should not be seen as consistent with those Russian warnings made 2 years ago. And frankly, I believe that they are consistent with those Russian warnings. And indeed, the Russians are providing a certain amount of assistance to Iran, assistance which they can continue to do, and which, by the way, since we're talking about intelligence and training and help perhaps with drone technology and perhaps missile technology and a certain amount of economic aid, that the Russians can continue to provide to Iran indefinitely without this causing any very great significant stress on Russian resources. The same, by the way, is not true of the United States. Ryan Beletic at the New Atlas has done another exceptional program over the last 24 hours, in which he has discussed at very considerable length the significant reduction of US missile arsenals, of Patriot missile arsenals, perhaps especially, but also of the various precision-guided missiles that the United States also produces, the JASSMs and those sort of things. And the depletion of the arsenals of these weapons is for the Pentagon a serious problem, because American production of these weapons is slow and protracted, and they cannot be replaced quickly. And they are exactly the same sort of weapons that the United States needs in the event that it finds itself in a conflict against China. And Brian Beletic made a further point. He mentioned a report by the CSIS. It said that in the conflict against Iran, there's no risk of the United States running out of weapons because inventories will never fall to zero because of continuing production. That is an absolutely meaningless statement, by the way. Nobody has ever suggested that the United States will run out of weapons altogether. I've never heard anybody suggest such a ridiculous thing. That is a classic straw man argument. The question is not whether the United States has no Patriot missiles or Tomahawk missiles or JASSMs missiles or air-to-air missiles at all. The question is whether it has too few of these weapons to achieve its military goals. And, well, we're starting to see that process perhaps play out in the Persian Gulf, in the conflict against Iran. But more importantly, as even the CSIS in that same in that same article admitted that the depletion of American arsenals of these weapons puts the United States in a potential disadvantage in any conflict with a third party. And of course, the third party at the back of everybody's mind is China, which of course continues to produce weapons of precisely this kind in staggering and continuous quantities. So the United States has that to worry about, as it has other things to worry about as well. It also has to think about its own production problems. Again, in that same video on the new Atlas, Brian Beletic pointed out that the United States, over the first 6 days of the conflict, launched 100 Lucas drones at Iran. Now, the United States has spoken a great deal about these Lucas drones. They appear to be a drone fairly similar, perhaps a copy, but perhaps more likely an American design and development, which bears a superficial resemblance to the Iranian Shahid drones and the American and the Russian Garand drones. But according to the CSIS, the United States was only able to launch 100 of these drones at Iran over the course of the first 6 days. 100. The Russians launch several hundred Garand drones against Ukraine every night. Iran has been launching hundreds, thousands of Shahid drones across the Middle East since the start of this conflict. The United States, its once mighty military industrial complex, is able to produce tens or hundreds of similar drones where its adversaries, Iran and Russia, can produce them in the thousands. And if we're talking about China, they, of course, can produce drones of this kind in the tens of thousands. That is the nature of the military, the growing military imbalance at some levels of production that we are starting to see. Anyway, there it is. We have other problems too. The USS Ford, Gerald Ford, America's biggest, most advanced, most powerful aircraft carrier, appears to be having a whole set of problems. When it was redeployed to the Middle East theater from the Caribbean, where it was deployed to put pressure on Venezuela, when it arrived in the Eastern Mediterranean, there were reports that the sewage facilities on the carrier had broken down, that the toilets in the carrier were poorly designed, which seems to me astonishing. I would have thought that by now, the United States has been building super carriers since the mid-1950s, I would have thought that by now they would be able to work out the efficient way to produce, to make latrines in a supercarrier, especially as, in some respects, the design of supercarriers has not changed fundamentally since the mid-1950s. This is a long and complex topic that I'm not going to discuss in this programme. But anyway, we're told that these latrines were not particularly well designed. Anyway, there was problems with sewage. The carrier had to go to, I believe it was Crete, the American base in Crete. There was had to be work done to get this problem sorted out. The carrier then redeployed to the Red Sea. There were expectations that it would then progress to the Arabian Sea to join the USS Abraham Lincoln. But instead, there appears to have been some other major breakdown. This time in the laundry system. This apparently caused a major fire. The fire took allegedly 30 days to bring under control, which I find extraordinary, just saying. And, well, apparently it has been brought under control now, and there's been no damage done to the carrier altogether. And nonetheless, some of the crew were injured as a result of the fire, and the carrier has had to leave the Red Sea and limp back through the Suez Canal to Crete, where it is again going through some kind of process of repair. I have to say that I find this all, well, a little extraordinary, and there is, I suspect, less being told about these incidents than perhaps the full truth is. The carrier has been on continuous station for 10 months. The crew must be very tired and very jaded. Of course, most of them will be young men, and they have obviously a lot more energy than some of us older people do. But after 10 months, especially 10 months of operations, first in the Asia Pacific, then in the Caribbean, now in the Red Sea, one can imagine that people are tired and that mistakes get made. The ship itself, after 10 months of continuous operation, it's not surprising, given that we're talking about massive and very complex machine, well, that it's starting to suffer from wear and tear issues and maybe experiencing breakdowns. I have, however, read some reports. They are exclusively on social media. There is no corroboration for them, that some of these incidents reflect poor morale on the part of the crew, and that there might be some, shall we say, intentional involvement on the part of parts of the crew who feel that they have been asked to remain on station for far too long without receiving relief. I am deeply reluctant to believe these claims. I would assume that highly trained, youngish or young men, probably highly motivated young men, would be unlikely to do these things. But if I was to say that I've never seen things like that happen in my time, I would not be telling the truth. For all I know, perhaps they are, but then again, maybe not. I'm not saying one way or the other. But anyway, there are problems. There are problems on the American side. There are problems on the Israeli side as well, that the Israelis themselves are apparently telling the Americans that they too are running out of air defense interceptors. So how long can this continue for? Well, Brian Beletic did say that he has seen pictures of US bombers carrying gravity bombs. These are, well, the American equivalent of the Russian fab bombs, only whereas the Russian fab bombs can travel distances of hundreds of kilometers, it seems that the American equivalent bombs can only so far travel for about 25 kilometers. So perhaps that does mean that in some parts of Iran, at least, air defense has indeed been degraded, and the Americans are able to conduct attacks on Iranian positions with gravity bombs. And the one munition, which I don't think there is any serious risk of the Americans running out of, is gravity bombs, just to say. But aircraft themselves, if they're continuously used, start to suffer from wear and tear issues. This is probably even more true of stealth aircraft, F-35s, which apparently have their own fragilities. At some point, we are inevitably going to see not just a reduction in the military tempo, but a sharp reduction on the military tempo. Already, it is significantly below what we saw in the opening days of the war. But before long, it's going to reduce below that too. Fewer weapons, personnel who are becoming more tired, airframes and other equipment that is beginning to run down and to suffer from breakdowns, all of that kind of thing. To repeat again, the United States, the military of the United States, is not configured for a long war. It has not been configured for a long war for a very long time. The rebuilding of the military industrial base in that direction has absolutely not taken place. On the contrary, over the course of the Ukraine conflict, I get the situation, the sense that the situation, if anything, has got worse, not better. And, well, the Americans clearly have those problems. No doubt the Iranians also have problems of their own. I don't know how many missiles the Iranians have. Obviously, their inventories are also becoming, over time, depleted. Whether the Iranians are able to keep manufacturing missiles during the war itself is an open question. But they can surely continue to manufacture drones. And of course, behind them is the industrial giant, which is Russia, and the industrial colossus, which is China. And if they ever become involved, well, then all bets are off. At that point, what is already a critical situation in military terms is going to veer into outright crisis. Now, on this question of China becoming involved, I read this extremely disturbing article in The Guardian by Dr. Jack Watling, who is a senior research fellow at Britain's Royal United Services Institute. The Royal United Services Institute is the most prestigious military think tank in Britain and perhaps the oldest military think tank in the world, at least of the ones that I know. And Dr. Watling is somebody I've discussed many times in connection with Ukraine war related matters. And there is no doubt at all that Dr. Watling is extremely well informed and well connected to people within the military system in the United States. All senior people within the British military complex are close to the military complex of the United States. These people all meet with each other all the time. They discuss ideas with each other. The Anglo-Americans have worked extremely closely together since the Second World War. And what a British member of this essentially single community tells us is probably true of all of it. So this is what Dr. Watling said in this article in The Guardian. Within the US strategic community, there is a fear that if China attempts to seize Taiwan in 2027, the world could find itself in global simultaneous protracted conflict. Here we need to change the actual words, because when Dr. Watling talks about the world finding itself in global simultaneous protracted conflict, as it as becomes clear from the rest of the article, what he actually means is that the United States could find itself in global simultaneous protracted conflict. And then he continues, to this end, the United States wishes to remove threats to its global operations beyond the Indo-Pacific, establishing coercive control over Venezuela, eliminating Iran's military capabilities, and neutralizing a hostile government in Cuba. Russia, by virtue of its nuclear deterrent, cannot be so reduced, and the United States has therefore been trying to build conditions so that the Kremlin would not intervene in any US-China confrontation. Failing that, the US is asking its European allies to take more responsibility for their own security. The US's military objectives against Iran are thus limited, as the chair of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, articulated to the destruction of Iranian military industrial sites and strike capabilities. Then Dr. Watling goes on to say that US political objectives are far more ambitious, and those, of course, align more closely with the Israeli objectives that I discussed in the in earlier in this program, which effectively amount to achieving regime change in Iran, which is the stated objective, this the objective that President Trump stated at the start of this military operation. So here we have Dr. Watling coming along and saying to us that, as far as the US military is concerned, all they want to do is to make sure that for a certain period of time, perhaps 2027, because that's when they expect a war with China to happen. 2027 is, of course, next year, to degrade Iran's military capabilities to the level that the United States doesn't have to worry about Iran as it takes on China in the Asia Pacific. Now, I have to say, I find all of this absolutely zany. The idea that Iran is going to start a war in the Middle East because there is a conflict between the United States and China in the Asia Pacific seems to me far-fetched, to say the least. Why the Iranians would put themselves at risk on China's behalf when China almost certainly has the capability to deal with the United States by itself, I cannot imagine. But I can believe that the American strategists, people like Elbridge Colby and others like that, might indeed be thinking in this way. Though my sense is that since I mentioned Elbridge Colby, he doesn't actually agree with the current attack on Iran. He thinks this is a distraction from what ought to be the primary goal, which is to confront and contain China in the Asia Pacific. But anyway, if this is the objective, if this is the plan, then we can see that exactly the opposite is happening. Instead of the United States degrading Iran's military capabilities so that it can focus all its efforts on fighting China, what is happening is that the United States' own military capabilities are being degraded, even as China's are increasing. And given what Dr. Watling is saying, is it not then in China's interest to see that Iran remains standing, that Iran continues the war, so that America's ability to prosecute a war against China in the Asia Pacific degrades even further? Is it not also in Russia's interest too? The Russians obviously are going to reap whatever benefit they can from the higher oil prices, but at the same time they understand that there is now a crisis for Ukraine, that Ukraine is no longer able to access the weapons supply, the weapons flow from the United States that it previously could, and that this is in turn creating a major crisis for Ukraine. And well, on that, we have an article in the Daily Telegraph, appeared yesterday, by Joe Barnes. Zelensky's Don't Forget About Me tour exposes panic in Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky is visiting London on Tuesday afternoon for talks with Sir Keir Starmer and to deliver a clear message: don't forget about me. The Ukrainian president was in Paris to meet Emmanuel Macron last week and in Romania for discussion on Ukraine's strategic direction. Earlier today, he met King Charles at Buckingham Palace. On Wednesday, he will fly to Madrid for talks with Pedro Sanchez, Spain's prime minister. And we're told that all of this is happening because of the fact that Ukraine sees Russia, its finances boosted by the rise in oil prices, and Ukraine's own position depleting because Ukraine isn't receiving the weapons that it did. The jeopardy is real for Ukraine. Stocks of American air defense missiles are being exhausted as they're used to defend against retaliation across the Middle East. Nobody in London, Brussels, or any other European capital is saying Ukraine is no longer important. But Western diplomats and officials are struggling to free up enough bandwidth to deal with two simultaneous major crises. And notice the word panic in the title. That word panic is one I have used at various times over the course of the conflict in Ukraine. I've no doubt that there is a major panic in Europe at the present time. There are all sorts of symptoms of it in relation to Project Ukraine at the moment. But note that this time, that word panic is not coming from me, it is coming from the Daily Telegraph, the very newspaper that has been the most enthusiastic supporter in Britain of Ukraine and which has relentlessly demanded support for Ukraine in every possible way that this support can be provided. So given that this is so, given that the conflict in Iran is depleting American arsenals, is creating this problem of bandwidth in Europe over the fact that they have to deal with two simultaneous crises, the one in Ukraine and the one in the Middle East. The fact that the oil prices are currently elevated, and that is helping Russia's finances and taking some of the pressure off the Russians. Might it not be the case that the Russians also, just like the Chinese, have an interest in keeping Iran standing, keeping the war there going? It's not, after all, as if the Iranians themselves show any interest in ending it now. Apparently, the new supreme leader, Muqtada Khamenei, and Foreign Minister Araghchi have both said that Iran is not interested in an interim ceasefire. They continue following the death of Larijani to seek to keep the war going. Their objective is to achieve fulfillment of all of their demands. They can see the growing economic pressure on the United States, on the president, on the global economy. They, of course, are aware of the depletion of the American reserves, and of course, if they sense that they have the Russians and the Chinese behind them, well, perhaps they're not under that much pressure at the moment to stop. So there it is. This is where we are in this conflict. Again, it amazes me how nobody planned or prepared for this in advance, that nobody in Washington seems to have thought it fully through. They were already aware of the depletion of stockpiles issue from the way in which the conflict in Ukraine had gone. They were aware of the stranglehold that China has over rare earths and of its colossal industrial capacity. They should have been aware that Iran does indeed have a stranglehold over energy supplies through its control of the Strait of Hormuz. Everything seems to have been based on the assumption that if the supreme leader of Iran and his immediate circle of advisers was eliminated, that would create a power vacuum in Iran, which would be filled by people more favourable to the United States and to Israel as well. That plan has already gone wrong. The decapitation strategy has obviously failed, but at least in Israel, for the moment, what they are doing is repeating the same thing over and over and over again, killing Iranian leaders wherever they can find them. Larijani yesterday, who knows whom tomorrow, and expecting a different result. Well, many people have said that this is a sign of insanity. I wouldn't go anywhere near that far. I don't get the sense that the people in Israel are mad or anything like that. It just seems to me that currently they have no realistic option but to do that irrational thing, the same thing again and again and again, and hope that eventually it will produce a different result. Well, anyway, in the meantime, the conflict in Ukraine continues. And I spoke about European panic. There is the first one very clear sign of panic, and that is that the Europeans, for the first time, have exerted themselves on Hungary's and Slovakia's behalf in a conflict that Hungary and Slovakia have been engaged in with President Zelensky of Ukraine. According to the Financial Times, European leaders have told Zelensky that enough is enough. He must finally allow the Europeans rights of inspection over the Druzhba pipeline. The Europeans need to see for themselves whether the pipeline is indeed damaged in the way that Zelensky says and what repairs are needed so that oil through that pipeline can again flow to Hungary and Slovakia, in effect to Europe, because as the Europeans know, without that pipeline being reactivated, the 90 billion euro loan that they all agreed to give to Zelensky in December cannot go forward because the Hungarians and the Slovakians are vetoing it, and European governments are not keen with increased direct funding of Ukraine, because that would mean going to national parliaments, which is something that no European government wants to do. So we can see the mood of crisis. We can see the mood of crisis and of panic with Bart De Wever's comments, the Belgian Prime Minister's comments about the need to reopen negotiations with Russia about Ukraine. We see that the Russians are in no hurry at all to begin negotiations of that kind. But in the meantime, the war itself continues. And here I should say that there has been another in a masterly discussion of the military situation provided by the person who I consider to be the most interesting and reliable mapper, who is Scott of Calibrated. And he has made the point, which I've made many times, that probably the most intense fighting over the last few weeks has been in the town of Konstantinovka in Ukraine, in Donbass to be precise. It is very strange that there is so little coverage of the situation in Konstantinovka. Like myself, Scott of Calibrated thinks that this is because around 80% of the information about what is happening on the ground in Ukraine reaches us, even us on independent media, from Ukrainian sources. And the Ukrainians do not want to talk about the situation in Konstantinovka because it has been going very badly for them. And Scott of Calibrated, I noticed, made exactly the same assessment as I have made, that most of the maps are wrong, that around 60% or more than half of Konstantinovka is now either in the grey zone or under Russian control. And of course, this matches almost exactly what the Chief of General Staff of the Russian military, General Gerasimov, said the other day, which I discussed in my video yesterday. But Scott of Calibrated also said something else, which is perhaps even more important and even more striking, more so than any other commentator of the conflict that I know of, except in fairness, Stanislav Kaprivnik, Scott of Calibrated, has pointed out that in the fighting in Donbass, the major objective of the Russians is always to capture the high ground. And that is exactly what in Konstantinovka they have been doing. They've been capturing all of the elevations around Konstantinovka and within Konstantinovka itself, which in effect puts the Ukrainian troops in Konstantinovka into what Scott of Calibrated described as in effect a fire trap, a situation where the Russians are able to look down upon them and are able to track their every movement and to attack them with drones and to shell them and to inflict disastrous damage upon them whilst cutting off their supplies. I said a few days ago that it seemed to me that the Russian newspaper Raydovka was talking about the emergence of a cauldron, in other words, an effective encirclement of the Ukrainian troops in the northern, northeastern parts of Konstantinovka. And to be frank, my assessment of what Scott of Calibrated has said essentially aligns with that Raydovka report. Now, lots of things are happening in other places. Scott of Calibrated has pointed out that despite whatever activity the Ukrainians have been engaged in northern Zaporozhye, about which he is every bit as sceptical as I am, the reality is that the Russians are advancing from the east westwards towards Orekhov. They are already within drone range, FPV drone range, of one of the major supply routes going to Orekhov from the north. The situation, in other words, for the Ukrainians in Orekhov is deteriorating. And Scott of Calibrated also made similar points about the state of the Ukrainian forces in the area of Slavyansk, in northern Donbass. There also, the Russians have been busy capturing the high ground around Slavyansk. They are very close now to beginning the operation to capture the village of Rai Alexandrovka, which would place them in a position where they would be able to look down on the supply roads between Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And, well, since Scott of Calibrated did his piece, an important village in precisely this area where the high ground around Slavyansk is located, a place called from memory Kalinivka, has also been captured by the Russians. So one could see what the Russians are doing. They're constructing their cauldron around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, even as they continue to push westwards and northwards towards the city of Zaporozhye and towards the Dnieper as well. And of course, Zelensky, at some level, knows all about this. He also knows that Ukraine's ability to counter Russian missile and drone strikes is diminishing. The Patriot missiles probably were never anywhere near as effective as he pretended. But for what it's worth, they're becoming fewer and fewer. The air-to-air missiles are now also in short supply, making it much more difficult to deal with the Russian Garand drones. And of course, whatever illusions there might have been about suffocating the Russians economically are going away. Even if, very unlikely, but even if the war in the Middle East, in Iran, were to end tomorrow, and the Strait of Hormuz were to be reopened, it would still take several weeks before energy markets returned to their pre-war condition, if they ever did. And it would probably take years of time before the United States was able to replace the weapons it has already expended in its battle against Iran. And that, of course, leaves essentially nothing for Ukraine. So that situation where the flow of weapons to Ukraine from the West would stop, it seems to me that we are now basically there. All before the Russian offensive, after the spring thaw, properly starts. Well, anyway, we will see. Now, before I finish this weird video, I want to briefly touch on Cuba. In that article in The Guardian that I spoke about, Dr. Watling spoke about how the US military wants to end, resolve possible areas of future conflict outside the Asia Pacific region, which is why it no longer wants to see a hostile government in Cuba. Again, I find this borderline crazy. What can the present government of Cuba do which could seriously threaten the United States? Why would the current government of Cuba, with a very rundown economy and a very rundown military, want to challenge the United States on behalf of China? What would Cuba gain by doing so? I mean, it makes absolutely no strategic sense if this is what the strategic thinkers in Washington are thinking, which, by the way, they probably are, or at least some of them probably are, then these are people who are ignorant of strategic matters to the point of illiteracy. But anyway, let's run with that. Let's run with that. That this is why the United States is trying to suffocate Cuba economically, is trying to force the Cuban president to step down. It wants major changes and reforms within Cuba. And of course, it's been imposing its own oil blockade in order to achieve that objective. And the Cuban government, to my puzzlement, has apparently been trying to negotiate some kind of resolution with the United States. Well, a few weeks ago, I discussed how there'd been meetings between Russian officials and Cuban officials, including President Putin himself with the Cuban foreign minister, and how the Russians said that they were prepared to provide Cuba with oil, which is, of course, what Cuba is critically short of. And I was expecting that a ship with oil, at least the first tanker with oil from Russia, would be steaming towards Cuba fairly soon. Nothing like that happened. Weeks have passed, And we heard nothing of this. And in the meantime, the oil crisis in Cuba got worse. And, well, I did wonder whether this was because the Russians were put off from sending oil to Cuba because they didn't want to tangle with the US. But I did wonder why that might be the case. And in fact, it seems that the reality, the real reason, was that the Cubans were nervous about accepting oil from Russia because they thought that that might affect their ability to negotiate their preferred outcome, which was some deal with the United States. Well, perhaps there's been a change of sentiment about this in Cuba, because it seems that Russian tanker, and this is a Russian tanker with flying the Russian flag, owned on the Russian merchant register with a Russian crew. Anyway, this tanker is now finally steaming towards Cuba, and it has 750,000 barrels of oil, which, if it reaches Cuba, it could provide to Cuba. Now, Cuba apparently produces around 30,000 barrels of oil a day and has to import around 70,000 barrels of oil. So it has run out. It has not been able to import oil for around 3 months. And it is critically short of imported oil, which is why we have this crisis, this energy crisis in Cuba at the moment. If this Russian ship reaches Cuba, then of course the oil, which is crude oil, will have to be refined, but presumably it would be refined and it would be available within about 20 days, and it would provide Cuba with, let's say, a sufficient supply of refined oil for around 10 days. Obviously, that could be stretched out longer if Cuba were to husband that oil properly. But it would still not be a long-term solution. Now, by my calculations, Cuba needs roughly 3.5 million tons of oil a year, 26 million barrels over an entire year in order to keep its economy functioning. Russia exports around 120 million tons of oil a year. The Russians can easily supply Cuba with all of the oil it needs. Cuba needs 3.5 million tons. Russia exports 120 million tons. The Russians would have no difficulty doing this. And I'm assuming that Cuban oil refineries, created to refine heavy oil from Venezuela and previously from the Soviet Union, can refine the heavier grades of oil, which is what the Russians export. So why hasn't this not been happening? Well, I'm going to make a guess, which is that the Russians obviously are not prepared, and made it very clear that they're not prepared to return to the arrangement that existed during the Brezhnev era, when the Soviet Union basically provided Cuba with its oil needs for free. It was Soviet economic aid to Cuba, not just oil, but other things, many other things in the 1960s and 1970s and early 1980s, which made it possible for Cuba to establish its free health system, its education system, to achieve all of the various things that the Castro government took such pride in. Obviously, the Cubans did this themselves, but they could not have done it without this underpinning of economic aid from the Soviet Union. Massive economic aid from the Soviet Union. Today's Russia is different. In fact, even the Soviets, after the death of Leonid Brezhnev, informed Cuba, the Soviet leader Yuri Andropov, informed Cuba in 1983 that the days when the Soviet Union would continue to provide Cuba with free oil were coming to an end, and Cuba needed to adjust to that reality. But that doesn't mean that the Russians would not be willing to provide Cuba with its energy needs. The thing is that the Cubans would have to make concessions too. And they would have to be significant economic concessions. The Russians might, for example, want a major slice of Cuba's nickel industry, its tourist industry, various other industries. Cuba, if it became over-dependent or fully dependent on Russia for oil, would become, in effect, dependent economically on Russia. Even more, perhaps, than it was when the Soviet Union, when there was the relationship with the Soviet Union. And I understand that a country like Cuba that has wished to resist outside dominance, that has fought so hard for its independence, might resist doing that. But what choice does it have? If Cuba accepts American offers, then of course whatever achievements were achieved under the Castro, in the Castro period, the health system, the education system, all of those things, would presumably, in fact, would undoubtedly be rapidly dismantled. If the Cubans want to preserve those things, the Russians are not going to object to them. They will want all kinds of other things. But probably that is the choice that the Cubans would make. I do not believe that the Americans, the United States, especially in conditions of a global energy shock, are going to go out and try to stop Russian tankers in the Atlantic bringing oil to Cuba. Doing something like that at this particular time could only increase energy prices still further. And I think that that is the very last thing that the president and his officials want. So there is this opening. The Cubans, it seems to me, ought to swallow what no doubt for them is a bitter pill, and they ought to take it. Whether they will, of course, is a completely different matter. We shall have to wait and see. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by checking our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.